Are you looking for something fun and unique to give away in your merch orders or at your shows? Look no further. Hit me up today to order 1-inch buttons for your band, label, or other project. High-quality metal pinback buttons for your friends and fans' battle jackets, messenger bags, and guitar straps. $33 for 100 buttons shipped in the U.S. Message me on IG at Everything Remade to get started. Hello, and welcome to Everything Remade, a podcast that I hope is about growth as much as it is about music. We have a great show lined up for you today, but first a couple bits of news. Have you listened to the new Komarov album? It's on Middleman Records Bandcamp, just came out this week, and if you are a fan of heavy as hell screamo with tinges of black metal, you must not miss this. Also this week, I released my new comic Dog Brain. It's 36 pages of weirdo horror wrapped in a heavy-duty cardstock cover. It's oversized at 8.5 by 7 inches, and I think it's the best thing I've done so far. $13, $15 sliding scale, shipped, included in the U.S. Hit me up to order. Of course, you can read that and any of my other comics on Patreon as soon as you sign up. The address is patreon.com/humanmachine. Also, there is lots of music stuff and behind-the-scenes sneak peeks. Patreon.com/humanmachine. And now, I'd like to play something for you. You're hearing How to Get Ahead by Stress Positions, featuring my new pal, Ben Rudolph, on guitar. Ben has a very rich history of bands, and it was awesome getting to chat with him about all of that.
Hearing War Pigs by Black Sabbath. I was living with my uncle for a while. My dad and I were living with my uncle, and I was going through his CDs, and I'd heard of Black Sabbath, but I had never really like actually listened to them. I was probably like 13 at the time, and I put on a bunch of other CDs that I would listen to a couple songs. I don't even remember what they were at this point. But just kind of general pop music, probably. Mm-hmm. And put that one on, and just like the way that song starts, I'm sure you know it, but mm-hmm. It's just ominous. And I just remember being like, "What the fuck is this?" You know. And like I sat there and listened to the whole CD, and then listened to it again as soon as it was finished. And I think if I had one moment, that's probably it. I mean, there were probably some other similar moments, but that's the one that really sticks out to me. Yeah. I mean, I also remember hearing like Smells Like Teen Spirit when I was like 9 or 10, and that being something that was similar, but not quite the same.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people mention Smells Like Teen Spirit, and it really makes a lot of sense because like as a guitar player, like later on, you can hear that and you can go, oh yeah, this guitar's, even though you knew nothing about it, it feels real accessible, doesn't it?
And it does. Yeah. It is. And that especially that song, I was chatting with our bass player recently, and we probably had the same conversation multiple times over the years, how that song just kind of gets better and better as I listen to it more and as I age. And I also went through a phase where I just thought it wasn't cool to listen to Nirvana anymore. Mm-hmm. And then very much came back to that when I realized how cool it is to listen to Nirvana.
Yeah, it's weird because like I was one of the people who like I was a big like Sub Pop head and everything like before Nirvana really broke. Like I'm a little bit older, and so like I remember listening to Nevermind on cassette in the back of the high school bus, and people being like, what are you listening to? And I'm like, oh, this band called Nirvana. And, you know, nobody knew who it was. And then it's not even 2-3 weeks later, and they're the biggest band in the entire world. And people were like, hey, didn't you know about this? Like, weren't you listening to this? And I was like, cool, for like 5 minutes, you know, because, and people being like, so what else do you like that, you know, and I'll tell them like, I don't know what I, you know, like something gross, you know, like, oh, the Meat Men, you know, or whatever. And they're like, oh, you know.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, but, that's too much for me.
Yeah. No, that's, no, this is weird. And you're like, yeah, it is. But, yeah, it, like, yeah, I don't know, you know, like, it's, there's something about that, you know, that, like, I'm sure they didn't do that on purpose. Like, let's just write this really easy song and people are going to be like inspired to make their own bands, you know, like that's not a conscious decision or anything, I don't think. But like, you know, even bands like in Screamo and stuff, it's like bands that like write super simple songs like Spirit of Versailles or something like that in, you
sure.
know, like people really latch on to that, and I don't know, there's something there. But yeah, that's awesome. Did you happen to there was a little clip of T-Pain doing War Pigs going around a couple weeks ago.
Oh,
did you
man.
Happen to
yeah.
see that?
Hell yeah, I did. That was awesome.
Yeah, the pipes, like, incredible.
Yeah, he crushes it. And I like that he's got like the heavy gospel band in the background.
Uh-huh.
Like that, I feel like that cadence for that song is perfect.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Sabbath are basically just a heavy blues band in the first place. So it just, I feel like it kind of just really took it to a place where it always was meant to be, and he fucking kills it, man. It's
yeah.
great. That whole record is awesome. There's like a Sinatra cover on there too. It's amazing.
Yeah. Huh.
And he does like Don't Stop Believing by Journey.
Oh, wow.
He just crushes all of these covers. It's great.
That's awesome. I'll have to look into that. I didn't know that was a part of a whole like cover thing.
Yeah. The record cover is especially good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what one other question is Sabbath related, and I feel like this is, you know, a very obvious question, but do you fuck with Dio Sabbath, or is it, are you a, like a no Dio Sabbath?
I'm not like a hard no, but for me, it's Ozzy till yeah. death.
Yeah. I mean, I can see like, how like you would be as influential and cathartic as that experience was. I could see how you'd be like, no, this isn't quite right. But like, I actually really love Dio Sabbath, but yeah.
If I'm being totally honest, outside of Heaven and Hell, I've never really delved too far into it, and I feel like maybe the boat hasn't necessarily sailed, but it's not something that has interested me thus far. But maybe I'll go back and have a more.
Yeah, I'll make the
holy dive,
as it were. Yeah, it's. I mean, Lonely Is the Word is just like such a like. I just fuck with that song so hard, and I'm just like, I want to make a screamo Lonely Is the Word like one day. Like, if there's gonna be just this long part in the middle that doesn't make a lot of sense, you know, and it sounds like wasted people are fucking in the background or something. You know, there's something absurd. Yeah. about it, but yeah, that's, you know, like, that's a super solid place to start for sure. Those two songs and bands. So like, how long was it till you were like playing guitar and stuff? Like, at what age did you start, you know, learning to play music?
I was probably already kind of playing guitar at that point. Like, at that point, I really liked like kind of just like radio rock music, and my parents are fairly young in comparison to most people's parents. So like my mom and dad are both in their early to mid 50s now. So when I was growing up, like, they were very much of the age of listening to stuff that was on the radio. So I actually loved like Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and Nirvana and Alice in Chains and all that stuff, and had already kind of expressed interest in playing guitar. So that's around that time I was playing guitar, but I think I learned most of Paranoid outside of all the solos, but just the riffs are so easy that I learned most of them around that time. So I think those times coincided very, very quickly. And I had been given a guitar for my bar mitzvah which had was also the guitar that I played up until I played it in my entire previous band. I only just stopped playing it a few years ago.
Oh, wow. What was it?
Yeah. It's like a, just a Mexican Fender Stratocaster.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've solid guitar.
The paint. Yeah, it is. You can like throw it around and it won't go out of tune. And I stripped all the paint off it and it somehow sounds better without all that, you know, really thick plastic paint on it.
Yeah.
I still have it. I just don't gig with it all the time anymore. But yeah, I'd say that time in my life is very much when I spent most of my time just playing guitar in my room. Like if I wasn't at school, which was a lot of the time, because I just didn't go to school half the time, I was just at home playing guitar.
Yeah. And was that down in Florida?
That was down in Florida. Damn, you did do your research.
Yeah. Was that in the Orlando area that you grew up, or was that like where you, like, did you move there once you like got out of the house, or what was that?
I was living in Orlando. I was born in England, actually.
Okay.
And I moved over to the States a week before my 13th birthday. And I had lived in New York City the first year with my dad. And then Orlando is where he's from originally. So I moved down there with him. And I spent age of pretty much 14 to, or almost 14 to 24 in Orlando. And then I moved up to Chicago.
Did you feel any sort of like culture shock in that? Like, I mean, I grew up in Florida as well, but like, I grew up in small town Florida. I grew up like outside of Fort Myers, like in a town with a graduating class of like 200. So,
oh wow,
it's different than Orlando.
So, Orlando would be a big city in comparison.
Oh, for sure. That's where we used to go to see shows. Like, you know, we went to see Danzig or something, and it was in either St. Pete or Orlando, you know.
Yeah, it would be in like the House of Blues or something like that, or
Janice, or I can't remember where we saw
Janice Landing. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember where we saw Danzig exactly, but yeah, we saw a lot of shows at at Janice, or there was another place for a while, the Brass Mug, I think. I don't know if that was in
That's in Tampa.
Yeah,
well, it was in Tampa. I don't think it's there anymore.
I didn't realize like until later. It's like when we're going to St. Pete, we're going to Tampa, we're going to Orlando. Like, I'm just like, yeah, we were just such like little country bumpkins, you know. But it didn't feel like it because it's Florida. It's like, but you're like, no, there's serious country people in Florida, and we were them, I guess. But yeah.
Yeah. But it's also, you know, it's not what, 2.5 hour drive. 3 hour drive up to Orlando, or
yeah, it was fine. Yeah, I mean, we were young. What else were we gonna do? You know.
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of the same thing. You know, I mean, I would go down to Miami once I started driving.
Oh, that's a haul Miami too. People don't understand. Like, Miami is so far. Like, you're like, oh, Florida's like Miami, Orlando, and like Gainesville or something, right? You know, it's like these are the big. It's like
Have Jacksonville, which is the largest city in the United States, technically.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean,
a square mile.
It's just like from Gainesville to Miami is like 10 or 6 hours. Is it six?
Yeah, it's about six. I mean,
I think
maybe
it was a lot farther than that.
The traffic can also dictate how long it takes to get down there. So
for some reason, I thought that like, cause I first band I was ever in, was based out of Venice. And, I thought that we drove like 6 hours to Miami, but like you said, it could have been 6 hours and it was just cause of traffic or whatever. But
yeah, I mean, yeah. I definitely made it down there from Orlando in about three.
Yeah. That's wild.
And I think there was sort of a kinship in punk hardcore stuff between Orlando and Miami. Yeah. At least when I was growing up. Gainesville too. I think Gainesville, Tampa, Miami, Orlando. At least when I was first, you know, going to shows every night of the week, it seemed, when I was 16 or 17, it was kind of everybody from those four cities sort of knew each other and were friends.
Yeah. Just like the DIY network, you know, like, hey, come play here when your band wants to play here, and then you book that band where you live, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah. I guess to answer your question, though, because it did veer off, when I first moved over here, it was more of a culture shock in Florida than it was in New York, probably, because I lived in London before I came over. So New York was obviously like big and scary and crazy, but also like more similar to how I'd already been living. Like, you know, I think in big cities, a lot of times it's way more common for kids to just be like walking around by themselves or taking the bus or train or whatever. So I kind of like had been doing that since I was like 10 or 11. So living in New York was more of what I was used to. And then going down to Florida was kind of like, you know,
like what,
big and open.
What's up with
big and open
people?
And sprawling. Yeah, that just like, you know, just like big roads and everybody drives and just miles and miles of strip malls and shit like that. That was something that I had not really seen before until I moved down there.
Yeah. Yeah. So Chicago is like just another, you're like, oh yeah, this is, you know, back to what you know, were used to sort of.
Yeah. I mean, I lived in Florida long enough to sort of forget all that, but not really, you know, I mean, yeah. I think just the sort of the natural progression was to want to move to a bigger city and somewhere that felt more like a musical mecca in ways.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
kind of why I ended up here.
It's, I usually start like at like, okay, let's talk about like the first band you were ever in. But here's the thing. You were in a lot of bands, and I did not realize until I started doing my homework today, like, just how many of them like I was familiar with and stuff. And
that's also crazy to me, because I feel like a lot of the bands I've been in, not a lot of people have heard. So that's cool. I guess if you're from Orlando, from Florida, that would make more sense.
Oh, I haven't been from Florida since your band. Like I've lived in Indiana for like 20 something years. So like,
okay.
But it's just like the person who knows somebody, and like, we know all the same people sort of, it seems, mm-hmm. you know? like, I'm sure it's like not your first band or whatever, but like Khan, you started like, that seemed to start around like 2011. And also Great Deceivers seemed to start around 2011. So Great Deceivers is like a Chicago based band, correct? But Khan was like Florida based. So like, your discography seems to, like, I think there's even a point where you lived in Philadelphia. Is that right? Or was it just some members of a band you were in also lived in Philadelphia?
So some members of, well, I'll backtrack.
Okay.
Great Deceivers started as an Orlando band.
Okay.
We kind of all moved to Chicago together.
Okay.
And our singer, guitar player, Max, and our other guitar player, Russell, who also plays in Stress Positions with me now, they moved to Chicago about a year before the drummer at that time and myself. Now the incestuous part about that is that that drummer who we moved to Chicago with was also the drummer in Khan. So there was a brief point when I was playing in both of those bands at the same time in Orlando.
Okay.
And then Knife Hits is the other band that you're referring to.
Yeah.
And we also started in Orlando. And then half of the band moved to Chicago, myself and Jono, who is also the drummer of Stress Positions now. We moved to Chicago, and then the other three people in that band moved to Philly. And because there were less of us in Chicago, once the band relocated, we just kind of said we were a Philly band. And most of the time we did writing and stuff, Jono and myself would go to Philly to work on music with them, because we both did like app jobs at the time. Like Jono did Lyft and I did Instacart. And that's when they would like let you work in different cities in 2015 or something like that. So we would go to Philly for, you know, 2 weeks and just kind of like sleep on people's floors or couches while we were there, and then work during the day and then have practice at night or the afternoon.
Yeah, that's
and then
yeah,
That's how we wrote the only Knife Fits LP that was written mostly in Philly.
Thing while you're just like doing whatever. And like I actually heard like there's a sort of a noise based musician that like tours completely by himself, and he's like, yeah, I'll show up in the town and then I'll like do Grubhub for like 3 hours, and then I'll like do a noise show, and then I might do Grubhub again for a couple hours after the show, and then go sleep in a parking lot somewhere. And I'm like, this is wild. This is fucking wild. But
yeah, grinding.
Say what?
Grinding.
Yeah, I mean, that's how, I guess, if the gig didn't pay for your gas, I guess that's how you're going to do it. But
and I feel like most time when you make noise music, the gig is not paying for your gas.
It's probably not. You're right. Yeah, you maybe have some very, very strange merch, like a cassette that somebody has to break a glass bottle to get to listen to or something, you know. Maybe you have that to sell for the
floppy disk.
Knife Fits was the band I was referring to, and it's wild because I can't remember how I got this, but I have like several copies of that in my label distro, like
probably from Dead Tank, who put it out, maybe.
It's possible. I don't remember if I did a trade with Dead Tank or not. Like, I remember that Dead Tank did buy some distro from me once, but I probably did a trade at some point as well. But yeah, I was just like going through your discography, and I was like, I have that in my distro. That's a killer record, you know. Like, and here,
oh,
here
cool.
we are. I contacted you because of something completely unrelated, and find out like, oh yeah, Great Deceivers is that other band that I catch every once in a while, like a new release or whatever. And like, it's, you know, obviously very different than your other stuff. Like that being a sort of more like Superchunk, Weaker Thans, Pixies, you know, sort of vibe than like all of your really heavy and like discordant stuff that you usually do. But yeah.
Totally. I mean, I started playing in Great Deceivers when I was 18. That's when we kind of first started playing shows. It was even more sort of twee and poppy when we started. But mm-hmm. I don't know. I've always just liked music across the board. And I just kind of always liked playing sort of polar opposite things to stay interested, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like,
and even now, I haven't played in a band that sounds like that in a while, but I actually just started playing with some new people in a band that's closer to how that sounds. So it's cool to have that dichotomy again, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a good palate cleanser. It's like I find that moving from something that even feels a little different to something, it helps me work out places I was stuck in the other thing by some mm-hmm. you know, logic. It's just like, and I often like look at making music as a puzzle or even like an operation that you're performing in some way, you know, and Yeah, it's just like when you approach a problem in one thing that makes you think outside of the box a little bit, then, you know, it sometimes just feeds that other thing. I don't know how to I probably have explained it better in a different show, but, you know.
I mean, I get what you're saying. I agree. And I think just to expand upon that, you know, the best way, I think, to get new ideas is by immersing yourself in different ideas and different like ways of expressing yourself. And like I would say like parts of songs that I've like directly lifted from music that isn't heavy and put it into like a heavier context, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've freely admitted to ripping off Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting and made a screamo version of it.
That's fucking sick.
Like, I'll send you the song. Like, I've never told people what song it is. Like, because I want somebody to call me out, but I'll tell you, like, I'll send you the link, like, after the conversation. But,
yeah, please do. I would love to hear that.
Yeah. But yeah, totally. It's, I mean, it's just like, I've listened to books about writing and stuff, and it's like, they're like, if you want to write, like, go for a fucking walk, you know? Don't think about writing all the time. Like, if you want to write, watch a movie, you know? Like, it's all this, you know? Like, living life and, you know, having different experiences is for sure the fastest way to unblock your art brain or whatever, you know? But,
Yeah,
you know, you're talking about, like, different angles, and that really made me and we're jumping around a lot, and I don't have a problem with that, but it was nice when you were like, let me backtrack to keep things on the rails a little bit. But when I was listening to the Stress Positions record, and this is a comment that I made to my friend Seth when we were talking about like how it was one of my favorite things, like just never heard of this band, is like, boom, it's just in your face and shocked me, and I was like, this is one of my favorite things of the year. But I was really like, I was really listening to it, and I'm like, and especially like in the first song, like right away, as soon as it gets going, I'm like, this feels like a band that writes songs from a lot of angles. Like, there's some songs where I'm like, this feels guitar first, but there's a lot of parts where I'm like, this sounds like the drummer had a really sick part and showed it to you, and you were like, yeah, I can do something with that. Like, how much truth is there to that?
The first part is true. There are definitely songs that I guess both parts are true to an extent. There are definitely songs that like I'll bring to the table as a guitar player that are pretty much fleshed out and sort of realized. And then we will then almost dismantle it and fuck with it, and things can end up changing. But sometimes it might end up being almost exactly the same. There are other songs where I'll bring a riff and our drummer is like, I don't know how I feel about that riff, but let me try this beat over it. And then he will play something that I'm like, damn, that beat is way cooler than this riff was. Let me kind of like reevaluate how I am going to play this part to the drum part that you've written to this original riff. So you're kind of right, but also it doesn't generally start with a drum beat first.
Right. It's just sort of like, this is how I'm interpreting it. And then you're like, wait, stay doing what you're doing. I'm going to match that kind of.
Yeah. Energy. Yeah, exactly. And that's also the beauty of playing with an extremely accomplished and talented drummer who I've been playing with since I was a teenager, that, you know, he can pretty much play anything. So it's sort of like gives me and Russell, the bass player, the sort of like easy platform to be like, okay, well, we can kind of mold to what you're doing because that was cooler than what we were doing in the first place.
Yeah, so, I mean, if a drummer is really sick, like your work is really cut out for you because you're just like, no matter what I do, it's going to sound cool.
Yeah, and he's also like extremely athletic when he plays drums as well. Like he plays the drums like he is like at war with them.
I love
and
that.
And it's and just so unbelievably fast. I like forget how fast we play sometimes until I see a video or something, I'm like, holy crap, like that's how fast people are.
I think it comes across on the recording too. I mean, I know that a lot of bands can get that sound, you know, through production or whatever, like without like that necessarily being the case. But I think you can tell the difference when a drummer is really like just attacking the snare drum.
Oh yeah. 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 And that's definitely what Jono's doing for sure.
Yeah. And there's just like such a visceral feeling like in your bones when you're listening to that and you're like, yes, this is what, like when you show up and you want to watch a band, you're like, that is what I want. Like, I want to feel like everyone is bursting out of their skin, you know, just like ready to
100%
explode.
Yeah. I mean, I love when I see a band who it makes me feel some type of way, you know what I mean? Where it's just like this. And you can tell too, when you watch somebody play, you can tell when it's like real and organic and that they're feeling it in their bones. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we definitely strive for, you know. I mean, I think also all of the, when I was getting into punk too, that's like what drew me to punk, is that it's just completely, or at least at once upon a time, it was just completely like just visceral. That was the only thing that it was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and obviously now it's it's evolved to a point where there's so many different styles and approaches, which are also fine. But I just think, you know, the sort of early days of that music starting is just, it was about being as pure and as visceral as possible, which is something that I definitely will appreciate till I cannot lift up a guitar anymore, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I've never minded when a band is so involved in what they're doing that they're having a hard time playing their instruments. Like, but you know, I mean, the goal is to still be able to play your instrument really well. But like when you can tell, you're like, this person is like losing their shit. Like, and like, it still works, you know, you're just like, it's fine. But yeah, it's wild. Like, you know, you know, I was saying that, like, when I was like digging into your, you know, back catalog and stuff, and then I'm like, your band before Stress Positions was Chew.
And correct. Yeah.
That was a band that was like, you know, like everyone was talking about this band, at least in, you know, my circles, like a couple years ago. And I'm just like, you know, I wanted to chat with you about Stress Positions because I like that so much. And then I'm just like, oh shit. Like I was obsessed with this kind of stuff like two years ago, you know, when this was all that, these bands like, you know, Gulch and everything like that were coming, just like bringing back this, I mean, I don't want to say bringing back, you know, but do you know what I'm saying? It's like this new wave of hardcore was forming around bands like, you know, Chew and Gulch and, you know, other bands like that. I think maybe
in the last like 5 to maybe 8 years, there's just been more hardcore punk bands who are kind of like just trying to do some different shit while it also being simultaneously extremely intense. Like Gulch for me is one of the, you know, they definitely, they weren't reinventing the wheel, but they had something different going on, you know, like they're an awesome band, but they seem like wild people too. I don't know any of that, but.
Oh, I don't either. Like,
I've seen some videos of their shows and they look pretty ridiculous. But, yeah. I don't know if you know this, but Stress Positions is the same instrumentalist as Chew. We just have a different vocalist. But it's pretty much the exact same band, and
the style's like night and day, though.
Yeah, some people say that, and some people think that it's pretty similar. I would say it's more of like an evolution of the Chew stuff. I mean, a lot of the Stress Positions material that's recorded currently, if not all of it, was all intended to be Chew music.
Really?
Yeah. I would say, I think I can safely say that all but two songs were written, at least the kind of, some of the riffs were written while Chew was still a band, technically.
Okay. And now, let me ask you, like, so from a perspective of, like, tone or gear, did you approach it much differently? Like, were you like, okay,
yes,
this is how we're going to differentiate? Because, like, that's maybe the biggest thing.
There's a few differences, and they are intentional to differ. I mean, one, because I think when Chew broke up, we were like, well, now we have the opportunity to, like, kind of, like, rethink stuff. Not that we wouldn't have in Chew, but I think we could rethink things a little bit more, because there were certain, like, stylistic things that Chew did that Stress Positions does not do. But I think there's a lot of similarities. One of the things we did was we down-tuned a half step. And then the other thing was I started playing a guitar with humbuckers, where I used to not play a guitar with humbuckers. And Russell, the bass player, is using a different amp and a different kind of approach to the tone on the bass. And I would say my guitar tone is definitely tighter and more focused sounding and less, like, jangly and all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think using the word metallic is not doing the best service as to how it sounds, but I think it just sounds a little tighter.
Yeah.
A little more like aggressive. I think it's like almost like a lot of the stuff we did towards the end of Chew is kind of just like sort of that on steroids. You
know? Yeah. Metallic is a strange word sometimes, but it is a good starting point for what you're, you know, for what you're describing, like the tone being. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is wild, because, like, you know, I think thinking back on it, of course, like, you can see a through line, like, you're like, okay, like, like, you can hear the hand in it of the person who crafted this and that, you know, you can hear that, but, like, it's just like reminding me of something my friend Parker said about, like, their bands, Two Nights and Fleshborn. And I was like, do you approach these two bands, like, much differently when you're writing? And they're like, no, Fleshborn is just Two Nights with lots of distortion. And it's like, yeah, I mean, you really can change a lot just by, like you're saying, just like focusing sort of the sound you're going for. Obviously the down tuning is, you know, like a big difference that's just gonna make. And like, I'm assuming this is also the point where you sort of, you said you're playing a guitar with humbuckers. So this is like where you stopped playing your Fender so much.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So that will do it. Cause I mean, I have a Strat also that I recorded one album. Like, I did a Strat in one side and like a hollow body in the other. And it's the weirdest sounding album we've made. it's something else, you know, it's different. And yeah, it can, you know, like, I could see people being like, thinking that was a branch off, you know, from what we're known for or whatever, just because of that, you know, because that does,
yeah,
gear does make a difference when it's a Strat versus, you know, something like a Les Paul or even an SG or whatever. But yeah,
definitely. And if I'm being totally honest, though, the thing that really separates the bands are that there's obviously different people doing vocals.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the two of them, Stephanie, the singer in Stress Positions, and then Doris, who sang in Chew, they're both exceptional vocalists with a lot of dynamics and, you know, an approach that is maybe not necessarily super traditional for that kind of music. So that's where they have similarities, but like their deliveries and lyrical content are pretty different in some ways. I mean, there's definitely some general themes that are pretty present in both bands, but
sure.
I'd say that the difference between them is pretty stark. So even though it's the same canvas for them to sing over, it's obviously very different people, you know, kind of approaching the same musicians and the same kind of music. So I think that obviously is probably the biggest difference, really.
Yeah, yeah. I was merely speaking like purely from the instrumental, you know, point of view. Like I think that, but you know, certainly both vocalists just like there's just like a lot of like original like delivery. Like it's really atypical, you know, it feels atypical, both of their deliveries. And like they're both very it feels deliberate and charismatic as well in both cases.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And they're both fucking pissed.
Yeah.
Like, I mean that's the most important thing. But yeah, that's yeah.
Yeah, how are you gonna not be right now, you know? But
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But yeah, the like, you know, Chu had a ton of releases, and then the final release, at least as far as we all know, was the live at WHPK, which, you know, it says
that's sorry to cut you off. That's cool that you know that that's actually the final release, because we just sort of put that up and, you know, as like a, oh, we had this recording that we weren't planning on doing anything with, but now the band doesn't exist. But that's cool that you are aware that's the last.
Yeah,
it's not technically a release, but it is the last recording that we put out.
I mean, it's fucking great. Like it's like, I don't know. It's everything that I would want out of like a live album if that was my band, you know?
I think that recording is the best representation of that band that exists.
That's awesome to hear that.
I think, and that recording was done, like you said, at WHPK Radio with a mics that were set up in about 30 minutes. And the person who mixed it barely did any mixing while we were actually playing. And we had just got back from like a month-long European tour, so the tightest
there
band ever was.
Yeah.
And Russell, our bass player, ended up mixing it once we got the files for it. So it is produced in a way. Like, he did spend a good amount of time mixing it.
Oh, for sure. But
I do think it's the best representation of that band. Like, that sounds like how we were never quite able to capture how that band sounded as well as we would have liked, I think.
Yeah.
I think we learned a lot of lessons as far as like how we want to record and how we approach recording and stuff. I mean, going back to the gear thing, it's a lot of partly why I switched guitars, because I sort of used to have to spend a lot of work trying to get my guitar to sound as nasty as I wanted it to when I played a guitar that was made not necessarily for playing like aggressive music, which was kind of part of the sound. But also, like, it was more difficult to get good guitar sounds. We spent a lot more time on guitar stuff,
yeah,
for that band.
Hardcore with a Strat has a unique quality that is like you know it when you hear it, you know, but like,
oh yeah, 100%.
When you're trying to do anything with a Strat that a Strat was not made to do, it is like fighting the tides, you know. It's like,
yeah, but it does a thing that a lot of other guitars do not do.
Yeah,
I think
they
a really
can.
Good
they don't.
A really good example of a Strat band in punk is this band called Acrylix. If you remember them.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
They were on the same label as Chew on Iron Lung, and we played a couple shows with them, and they were at when they were around one of my favorite punk bands that was going. But their guitar player, just impeccable guitar player, so creative and weird, catchy, but played it was definitely a Fender guitar with a trem bar, and it you put on their record, you're like, you know exactly that's what that guitar is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's wild. There's sometimes it's when you're doing something, you're trying to go for something specifically, you know, there's always like a part of me that like I want this guitar to sound so fucking gnarly and nasty and whatever, and there's like you do it, but then later when it comes to like actually mixing or whatever, you're like, wow, that was a mistake. Like,
because
like once you go there and it's just like, you know, this is related to the Strat because it's like there's just that quality like you can't back away from, you know. And
yep,
yeah, I don't know. It's a, you know, obviously plenty of bands making the Strat work and sounding cool, and I mean it'll show back up in one of my recordings at some point, you know. But
yeah,
I don't know. What did you end up going, like what guitar did you end up going to?
I play a Gibson Firebird now with the classic Gibson Firebird pickups in there, which are technically mini humbuckers.
Okay.
But yeah, that's been my guitar since actually the end of Chew, pretty much. I think the last Chew show, which was in 2020, which was never intended to be the last show, I had actually used that guitar, and I think we had actually tuned a half step down for the first time at that show.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. And then we broke up during the pandemic and just never played again. We never will.
Was that weird? Like, was that weird for anyone? Like, so you tuned a half step down, but you just, if the song started on the fifth fret, you started on the fifth fret.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Like, did that fuck with you at all at first? Like, cause
It fucked with Doris a little bit because she was, you know, even if you're screaming, you're still kind of screaming in a key, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
I think she did not like it at first. And that show being the first time we did it, I think also, to be honest, at least her and myself probably had COVID at that show.
Oh, shit.
Like it was Ian's party, which was always in like mid-January. And her and I were both sick as dogs and didn't want to cancel. And obviously that was in 2020 where no one was really paying attention to the fact that it was going to, you know, there's no possible way that COVID could come here, you know?
Yeah. Nobody knew even what it looked like or yeah.
Exactly. So I, you know, looking back on it, we definitely were both extremely unwell and, you know, in the spirit of rock and roll, we're like, we can't cancel the show. And played the show pretty unwell.
Yeah.
And it was probably one of our worst shows we've played in a year as far as our performance goes. I mean, maybe the other people think differently, but Doris and I are, we've talked about it before, and we're both like, yeah, that was a pretty bad one.
Yeah. It's, you know, from a vocals perspective, like if it was difficult for the person to always be in that higher, slightly higher, you know, or whatever register, then dumping down would be a relief. But if that's
just
where you went automatically, then it would be like, you'd be like, what the, how, do, now I have to consciously sort of downshift.
I also think it being a half step versus a whole one kind of makes it difficult
even
as well.
Weirder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously when Stephanie started jamming with us, we had already been all the songs were already in that key. That's, so
yeah,
when she came in, it was like, okay, these are just keys. Songs are in. You know?
Yeah, this is just what it is. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a couple projects, and one of them, it's like I'm in D standard, and in a different one, I'm like drop C, and in a different one, I'm E standard, you know? And, it's like occasionally just like pick up a guitar and not really remember what I just had it tuned in. Like, and, be like, oh, that sounds weird as hell. Like, that's not what I should be doing with that. Which is obviously it's horrible for your guitars. I don't recommend it, but I don't have any, like, I do have a guitar that's my baby. I love it. But it's still a $200 guitar. It's just very, my wife gave it to me, 20 years ago. So it's like very sentimental. Yeah, they're all $200. All my guitars are $200 guitars. So like, don't at me for like, yeah, sometimes it's tuned in this and sometimes it's tuned in that.
Yeah.
It is what it is. But yeah, it's a good thing they didn't record that show. That's, we could leave it at that. And you know, everybody that has not listened to that, live at WHPK, like definitely go download that now. Cause that is it. Like it's perfect sounding in my opinion.
Thank you. That's really kind of you to say. That's especially like I'm far enough removed from it from where just hearing that kind of stuff makes me feel really good.
That's awesome. Yeah. So, you know, we've obviously been talking about Stress Positions and, you know, the album Harsh Reality. It came out in December. It was like sort of one of those, like I said, like I saw y'all were either going on tour right after the album came out, or you were just doing some touring right before. So I had been seeing the name around a lot. And then of course my pal Daniel had done the album artwork for that. And,
cool. You know, Daniel.
I think that's immediately what put it on my register was, Daniel being like, oh, I can finally share this artwork that I did. But like,
I love their art so much.
Yeah. Just they like are. such a unique visual style. Like
it's so recognizable, and he's done art for so many different bands now.
Yeah,
you can instantly pick. You can instantly pick out his art when you see, as soon as you see it, you're like, oh, that's Daniel Harris. Like,
yeah,
and he's. I just think he continues to get better and better.
It's wild too, because collage as a medium, like, there is absolutely the potential for anyone to have such a distinct and like unique voice, like as any other medium. But like, Daniel is just one of those people, like they just really nail it. Like, and you are absolutely correct. Like when it's their piece, like you can just tell. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that was released, but like, it doesn't say on the label Bandcamp page, but, I could be wrong, but that was released by 3-1-G.
It was. Yeah.
That's wild. How did that come about?
I sent them an email, a cold email through the portal in their website, which is shocking that actually worked.
Wow.
I mean, I can't tell you how many record label email portals I've submitted music to in the 20 years of playing music. But, I guess technically the same thing happened with Iron Lung when they put out the Chew stuff, but that was a little different because, the folks who run that label actually knew who we were and already distroed some of our records. And we knew that, but we weren't on like a first name speaking terms with them. Right. You know? I mean, we had like met each other before, but like we were definitely not friends, and we've since become friends. But so that was a little different. That was more like, you know, hey, like you've distro our records, like, do you want to put out our LP type thing? Mm-hmm. This one, the 3-1-G thing, I mean, we would have been very happy putting out a record on Iron Lung again, because they're amazing, and, you know, they have sort of got to the point where I think their taste is sort of always changing, but still very much, you know, very much them. Mm-hmm. And I think we just wanted to try and go a different direction. I don't think 3-1-G is necessarily like a step up or step down. It's more like a lateral move. But I think we just wanted to like kind of just work with someone different, have, you know, be exposed to like a different audience, given the fact our first Stress Positions record came out on Iron Lung 2, you know, just try something else. So I emailed like, you know, 10 different labels through the means in which they have available online. Mm-hmm. Some of them just have like portals that the same as 3-1-G. Like I messaged like Sacred Bones and shit, just like knowing they'll never get back to me, but I'm like, yeah, might as well try. And I got an email back from Justin Pearson like the next day. And it was basically like, hey, I listened to the record. I really like this. And I generally, you know, I always try and listen to submissions. So you would at least got that, but I really like this record and I would like to help put it out in some way. And that was just kind of shocking because, you know, having never met somebody, sending them a cold email, you're not really expecting an email back. So, yeah. It was pretty cool that he not only listened to the record, but also liked it enough to actually consider wanting to help us put it out. So that's kind of how that started. And since then we've become friends and they've been great to work with. And it's, you know, I mean, he's somebody who's been making music and involved in DIY for almost as long as I've been alive. So
yeah, no, the Locust played in my old basement in like 1999 or something, 2099, somewhere around there. So yeah, I know.
yeah. And, you know, the Locust at one point were one of my favorite bands, and Swing Kids were one of my favorite bands.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I think the catalog for them is endless and weird. And I think that's partly why it was something we wanted to try, because they just always put out kind of whatever the fuck they want and isn't necessarily stuck to a certain genre, which is kind of more of what we were looking for versus just being on like a label that puts out mostly hardcore, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my first screamo band was a deliberate Crimson Curse ripoff. I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard, and I want to do that.
That's sick.
And
yeah.
Yeah. So, like, it's probably wild for anybody if somebody's like, what's your Justin Pearson band? And I'm like, the Crimson Curse. And people are like, what's wrong with you? But I'm like, that's the one. It just, they got like, only around a dozen songs or whatever, but just like, bam. but yeah, that's awesome. And I mean, it makes it, it's like you said, like lateral, and it just, I mean, to me, like they were always the weirdo label back in the day. And like, that's what I'm all about. I'm like, yeah, I'm like, we're weirdos. Like, let's do weirdo shit, you know, let's go for it. But, yeah. So it's you know, it's wild. Just like I said, like you know, your back catalog is amazing, and I think that anybody who hasn't checked out, you know, Khan or Great Deceivers or Knife Hits, or you know, obviously most people are probably know Chew and are hearing Stress Positions.
It is funny that you mentioned Khan, actually, because that's not—it's not one that people generally mention when talking about bands I was previously in.
It's certainly the one that I had not heard of, and I did go and, you know, and listen through, and I'm like, yeah, I mean,
I'm only on the second record. I was the vocalist on the second record.
Oh, okay, okay. It's like, it all makes sense to me, you know, because like I. Like you mentioned, you know, you have your like tastes from one end of, you know, the punk or indie, you know, or metal spectrum to the other. And I don't know, it always makes sense to me when you're like, okay, yeah, so like somebody would go from a band like that sounds like not, I don't think Khan specifically sounds like that, but it's like, you know, Behold the Octopus or something, you know? And to a band like Stress Positions. Like that makes sense to me, you know, where it might not make sense to a lot of people. But I think people should definitely, you know, go through and check out all that. That was always my favorite thing, like when I was a kid. And then you hear Minor Threat, and then you're like, this person's also in this band called Fugazi. And then, like, you know, the next thing you know, you're like, what were the other people from Fugazi were from? And then you hear Rites of Spring, and then you're like, oh shit. And, you know, your mind just starts getting blown. And I hope you
actually, to sort of circle back too, I just remembered, because I don't know if you looked at Discogs or something, but I don't know if it's up there, but we were talking about Daniel. I actually played bass on the first Vivian Kay record too.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. I didn't know that. Yeah. And we've played with Vivian Kay lots of times. They kind of like, they kind of never really had like an actual, like, were you in the band or did you just play?
I think I played, I recorded that EP, which is called Vivisections.
Uh-huh.
That's when they first moved to Chicago. I think realistically, I was just too busy with my other two projects and couldn't commit fully to it. And then that was around the time that Cass, who eventually played bass for them, moved to Chicago, and she ended up playing bass. And that's when they started really touring. So I don't think I ever played any out of town shows with them, but I definitely played at least 4 or 5 shows in Chicago with them.
Okay, because I think that we played all our shows with them, well, like while they still lived in Florida, and I don't think I'm gonna go out on a limb, but I don't remember them having a bass player when we played any shows with them.
Now that I think about it, they did have. At least one album where it was just Danny and Jesse before Vivisections. Vivisections is the first one where they had a bass player.
Yeah, possibly. It's like, yeah, I just I remembered like that not being the case that they had a bass player. And then like you said, like they moved to Chicago and then it was kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, this makes sense because, you know, they were already playing in bands with Cass and stuff, so... Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. And Vivian Kay, like, just like a lot of fun, like great band. As we sort of wrap up, like I say this all the time is like, you want to chat with somebody because they just released a thing, but then there's always the part where you sort of have to ask like, what's going on in the future? Like, are y'all just like, we're so stoked to have this album out, or are you like already like halfway into a new album? Are you working on like, you know, booking more tours or have any shows to announce?
I guess the full update would be we're still very stoked on the record, even though we've been playing those songs for 3 years now. Those songs were also recorded with the first record that we made. They recorded all in the same session, and then we broke up the material, and they were mixed by different people and mastered by different people, so they would sound different, but they're from the same session that was in 2021. So we've been playing all of those songs, you know, since mid-2020. But still very stoked that the record is out, and we're touring the West Coast. We leave on April 8th. To start that one, it's like 3 weeks out there, and then we'll be doing a short East Coast tour in June. We're playing Break Free Fest this year, which we're all very excited about.
Oh, awesome!
In Philly, and then as far as the U.S. goes, we won't be doing anything else really outside local or regional stuff before the fall when we go to Europe for about 3 weeks. That will be the first time for this band. So also extremely excited for that. But as far as other stuff goes, we just wrapped up recording on new EP a week ago. and that's being mixed right now. It's just a six songs, 12 minutes, I think. So it's pretty short.
Hell yeah.
But we're pretty stoked to just be able to play some new stuff, pepper in some new stuff. Like I said, we've been playing the other material for a while, but it's also, I mentioned earlier about how a lot of this material was all Chew stuff. The new stuff that's on this next record is the first batch of songs that is completely written with that didn't have the previous band in mind. Mm-hmm. So these are the first. I mean, there were a couple of Stress Business songs, I guess, that were written, kind of finished later. But for the most part, the riffs were written when Chew was still a band. So these are kind of, for us, like, exciting because they're all material that we've worked on together from the very beginning.
Do you feel like you approached the songs like when whatever angle you were specifically citing as the difference between Stress Positions and Chew became apparent to you, that when you're writing these new songs, you're like, all right, we're going straight in that direction? Like, did it feel more, even more like purpose? Like,
I think so. I think so.
Yeah.
Something that myself and Russell tend to do when we're writing music together is that we write batches of songs in the same key. Mostly because we like things to, like, an album to sort of feel like one long song.
Mm-hmm. I call it the mega song.
The mega song, yeah. So, and that's something we did with the last two Chew records as well. But sometimes, like, the key that the songs are in kind of dictates the feel of the songs, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say that this record is, like, it's more relentless than before.
Oh, wow.
It's probably some of the most, like, pissed off and mean shit we've ever written. Like, mean as a sonic descriptor. Like, it's pretty furious sounding. And it's definitely somehow faster than some of the other stuff. There's blast beats in every song, which I can't say about the LP. We definitely like blast beats and wanted more of them. But there's also some shit that's weirder, I think. A little bit more, like, kind of pushing the weird side more, but also pushing the sort of, like, really, like, just, like, I don't know, straightforward punk shit more at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's also a song that's, like, kind of, like, you know, a straight up, like, mid-tempo noise rock song. So it's exciting. We're all excited to just, like, have, like, a new batch of shit. And, I'm just excited to be able to play it. But I also, again, happy that the LP's out and that we weren't able to tour for a while. Our drummer was doing a tattoo apprenticeship, so he was focusing on that. So we were doing weekends and stuff here and there, but we haven't really been able to tour. But now he's tattooing full time, so he has a bit more time to be able to tour. So that's exciting for us because, you know, we like to do that.
Yeah, you really get to get out there and, you know, play the songs that you've been working on, and, you know, you have your records to show for it, and that's
I also just don't like the idea of making physical records and not touring on them.
Yeah.
Like, unless you put them in people's hands, like, you know, it's for me, it's hard to justify making things out of plastic if you're not going to be, like, putting them in the hands of people who are going to actually enjoy the thing that you made. Otherwise, it's just like a waste of a resource, you know?
Yeah, it takes so much time, and it's so expensive anymore, and there's so many people that had to work to make it happen, you know? So for sure, when there's a band that, like, really does everything they can do to show that they are willing to back that, you know, they're walking the walk as well, you know?
Yeah. And I have no desire to like make physical records for a band that doesn't tour.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
There's another band I'm playing in here in Chicago that hasn't played a show yet. It's a slow burn kind of band. We've been working on it for almost 2 years now. And that band has no prospect of touring. Maybe we'll play a couple shows out of town at some point, but just because of the nature of the careers of some of the people in the band, we will never tour. And I am perfectly fine with that happening. And then just, you know, the music existing on the internet.
Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty, right? Like, you don't have to do that anymore. So you can have bands where you're just like, nah, it's cool. And I mean, my situation now is like, it's like, I have a setup where I can like make my own tapes. So it's like, hey, like I'll make my thing and I'll make 20 tapes. And if people want to buy them, cool. If not, that's not such a big responsibility financially or otherwise, you know what I mean? So yeah, excuse me. That's awesome. And I look forward to hearing that new band whenever that sees the light of Bandcamp, as it were.
Yeah, there's actually, and just to plug one more, I'm playing in another new band called Bursting. That's we're playing our first show on April 4th.
What's it called?
Bursting.
Okay, I thought that's what you said, but I wanted to make sure. That's awesome, and that'll be around Chicago.
Yeah, that's going to be at Empty Bliss.
Empty Bliss. April 4th
with Ed Hockley.
Oh, sick.
Yeah. They're good buds of ours.
That's going to be a wild show.
It will be, yeah. And that band is, I'm excited to mention it earlier, but I'm excited about it just because it's music that I haven't played that style of music in a while. So it's been cool to get back into that groove.
And that was my conversation with Ben Rudolph. Thank you so much, Ben, for taking the time to chat with me. Thanks to all of y'all for listening wherever you are as well. Make sure y'all dig into Ben's back catalog of music, as you are sure to find something you'll like. And speaking of back catalogs, did you know that you can download the entire Middleman Records discography from Bandcamp for something like $20? It's a ridiculous amount of music and podcasting for the price. Like, it's like 10 cents an album, and that's not including the nearly 200 episodes of podcasts that you'll get as well. That's middlemanrecords.bandcamp.com, of course. Anyway, until next time, take care and do good things.